text 51551. Today with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Time now for our Friday gathering. The panel has joined me in studio. First, though, a listen back to the big stories of the week.
Hallinan rejoices and celebrates. 14 points the margin of victory. It's all over. And Tipperary are the All-Ireland hurling champions for 2019.
I thought it was a very not nice way of saying something. They could have told me no. Now, Denmark, I looked forward to going, but I thought that the Prime Minister's statement that it was absurd, it was an absurd idea, was nasty.
It is with regret and surprise that I received the news that President Trump has cancelled his state visit to Denmark. I had been looking forward to the visit.
Everything points to this device being set in place to catch police officers lured into the area by that phone call to try and kill them. Many of us sense that things are becoming more entrenched.
But I think actually we'll get there. I think there is a real sense now that something needs to be done with this backstop. We can't get it through Parliament as it is. So I'm going to go at it very, very with a lot of oomph.
We cannot get into a bilateral discussion on how an EU border will function in the future without the EU input on that. We are not in the business of facilitating the UK effectively moving away from commitments that they've made to Ireland and the EU.
Well, that great compilation was put together by Amy Ryan, and with me in our studio is Shona Murray, Euronews correspondent, Colm Brophy, Fine Gael TD for Dublin South West, Colette Brown, Irish Independent columnist and barrister, and Eamon Ryan, Green Party leader and TD for Dublin Bay South. You're all very welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you all desperately want to discuss Brexit, so we are going to start on Brexit. Actually, you were just saying the word backstop is unfortunate.
It is unfortunate.
In itself, as a word.
Because the very thing we're standing by, and it's the centre of this whole debate, is a back and a stop, neither of which are very positive words. It should have been a further width, or a future width, or a safety net or something.
That's a good point, actually.
It's not a great thing to be fighting for, but it's something we have to fight for.
They
now
say, actually, during the referendum in 2016, that the worst thing you could have said was remain. They should have said stay, because remain is a, sort of a supine wording, whereas if you had stay, it's something forthright, that you want to stay within the European Union. Exactly, whereas, you know, leave was believe, and there was something active about it. So maybe it's all down to language that we're in. Well, it is actually all down to language that we're in the situation.
When they were coming up with backstop as the word, ever thought that all these years later and all these millions and millions of radio and TV shows,
we'd all still be talking
about
backstop. Yeah, we wish it was never invented as a word. Shona, I suppose we've had Boris doing his tour with Emmanuel and Merkel. What is the situation right now, and what alternative arrangements are the British talking about?
Well, that's the problem. They aren't discussing any alternative arrangements. I heard Adam Bridge in here on Monday. Trusted Trader Schemes. I mean, Trusted Trader Schemes is a replacement for an international peace treaty, essentially, is what he was saying, and giving no rollout of what it could look like, no prescription of how it would deal with, you know, crisscrossing of the border, the all-island economy, and basically, you know, saying that this is what we would put in place, or suggest to put in place, after 3 years of demanding that the UK be able to leave the EU without listening to their obligations under the Good Friday Agreement. So but where we're at is that, once again, I don't know why I'm surprised, but looking at the British press over the past couple of days, deliberately misleading the public about what was said by Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron, who've been absolutely consistent in their position. Yeah.
They jumped on the 30 days.
You could tell even by her tone that she was just being polite to say, look, of course, we'll listen to your alternative arrangements. We won't be reopening the withdrawal agreement. But if you want to give us something on the table within the next 30 days, then we'll be very happy to listen. The same with Macron yesterday. You know, the backstop has to be there to protect the single market and, of course, the Good Friday Agreement. And the idea that they would have reneged on that is quite shocking, given Angela Merkel's position when she came to Dublin a few months ago, where she listened to people who had been affected by the Troubles, and herself coming from East Germany. And it just goes to show you how ignorant it they are in the UK about what the EU is about, that it isn't just the single market, that it is a peace project. Mm. But actually then you kind of say, well, look, and they all they do is reference World War II the whole time, but yet they can't see this part of it.
I think it's interesting as well that a majority of Northern Ireland MLAs have now written to the European Commission to say that, hang on, we're actually in favour of the backstop, and you know this thing that's become such an international bone of contention, and we have Boris Johnson claiming for the entirety of the UK that they don't want the backstop, that it will be detrimental to the future of the UK itself, that he said it was undemocratic. Meanwhile, you have people who are actually living in the region who say that yes, actually we do want this. And the problem has been for the duration of Brexit since the referendum that you have the DUP as the voice of Northern Ireland, and any other voice has been drowned out, particularly in the debate in Britain itself, because as we all know, Sinn Féin MPs don't take their seats. The British press don't seem to have any interest in Northern Ireland itself, other than what's said about it in Westminster. So you have this vacuum which has arisen in the debate within the UK, and the voices of people in Northern Ireland are not being represented except by our own government in Dublin, and I think that is hugely problematic.
It is obviously up to the government to do that representation, but I think to go back to one of the key problems that really has developed over the last week or two, particularly with the British media coverage of this whole thing, is that you can see as they perceive this moving towards an election, and as they perceive Boris Johnson's government moving maybe towards an election, you're getting these entrenched views. It's ideological writing of stuff. It's nothing to do with facts. It's nothing to do with reality. It's pretty much people going back to the bunker positions which they take, and then writing the story and the coverage out of that, and very much, I think, with a view to fighting the next battle rather than actually looking towards resolution.
Just one thing. It's not just the wording of the backstop maybe is unfortunate, it's also the fact that at the end of the day, this is the key item in the supposedly stopping progress, which it isn't. It's just a cover. And one of the reasons why what the UK negotiators haven't understood, and we're very close to our European colleagues, so we meet regularly with them in terms of what's their view, it isn't just defending the Irish peace process, although that is strong as an instinct, but it's also an understanding that the protection of the single market, which is not small and is under threat. And what they realise, and what the British government has recently kind of articulated in a way makes it very clear, is that what the British government's intention is to deregulate, to have less effective regulations. And for Europe, that's a real threat, where you say, so we're going to allow this competitor in our area, who's going to have lower environmental standards, lower labour standards, to kind of go this very far right way in competition, do a deal with Trump in the US. So if you're Angela Merkel, or if you're Macron, and you're trying to hold European standards, you're not going to cede on that. So it's not just about the backstop. And the reality is, even if the withdrawal agreement was agreed, which is, I think, the most likely way out of that impasse, is maybe we had an Ireland-only customs arrangements. You still then have to do a trade deal, and you're still in the exact same row with the European Union, now not just with Ireland, but particularly with your other neighbouring countries, about whether you're willing to maintain some sort of regulatory standards.
There's one very important, I think, additional point which gets lost in the way we look at the story here, because we cover and we focus on the backstop, and there's some people even peddling the notion here in Ireland that if you got rid of the backstop, we'd solve Brexit nearly in the morning if the Irish government did that,
or
the EU did that.
People are entitled
to
hold.
But it's really important. What's never really given coverage, the ERG, the main group which effectively is the heart of the Brexiteer movement, have made it quite clear that the withdrawal agreement in its totality, the other provisions of it, the provisions that Eamon was referring to there, are as much problematic to them as the backstop.
Yeah, but I think they could easily
notion that the backstop, if it was somehow magically gone in the morning, would cause this ERG group and these Brexiteers to move, I think is completely misleading people.
I think they could be appeased because of the political declaration. You can have a Canada minus trade deal anyway.
Mark Francois has actually said
that he'd vote against it, even if
yeah, but you would still get a majority in the House of Commons.
If you got the right thinking, if the British MPs acted, and it's up to them to act fact it's their own parliament. But there is a majority, obviously, in the House of Commons for sensible action and for leaving. And
is
for
there?
I think there is, yeah.
We haven't actually seen any evidence of that thus far.
We haven't, unfortunately, because of the internal politics of the United Kingdom. But I do think we're reaching a real end game here where members of the British Parliament are going to have to make a key decision.
I'm actually going to move on from Brexit because I do think also there's listener fatigue, actually, you know, just more about Brexit and the backdrop. Guard the reform, we were discussing it on the programme today. Colin Brophy.
Yeah.
There is a fear in parts of rural Ireland, we were talking to Paul McLaughlin and Sean Fleming, that local people in local communities are very worried about the new divisional changes.
I don't think necessarily I would describe it as a fear in rural Ireland. I would describe it as people trying to stoke up a fear in rural Ireland. I think I thought some of what Sean Fleming said, and I listened to him, was absolutely atrocious.
He said it should have been made at cabinet level.
Oh, I won't even go into that, because if there's any hint that policing decisions are made at cabinet level, Fianna Fáil spend the next 2 years complaining about it. So I thought that was rank hypocrisy. But the thing that really worried me the most about the type of country that he was making was, on one side he said, well, sure, I'd welcome it and be delighted to support it if it delivers what we want. And on the other hand, he then tried to play the local card on it. This is one of the best reform packages that a leader of An Garda Síochána has put forward in decades. It's exactly what was asked for in terms of the reviews. And by the way, the extensive consultation with the rank and file of the Gardaí, with the community, with the Oireachtas members, I don't know where Sean was maybe when that was going on, but with all that communication and consultation which took place in the recent review. And they all talked about the fact that the Gardaí was too hierarchical, needed to be community focused, and one very important thing, needed to put more Gardaí on the street, facing, interacting. That's exactly what this reform
Colette,
does.
I suppose shifting the focus maybe to community-based crime, that the idea is here, but there are concerns that turf wars might break out in rural areas because control of the new Garda divisions will be geographically remote from the communities they serve.
Yeah, I think we could have, you know, what we saw, what kind of when attempts were made to reform the health service and hospitals were being closed or downgraded, and certain services were being taken away from communities, and people automatically view that as a loss and try to, you know, retain the services in their local area, or the, you know, the designation of what the police station in their area is. And I think that would be a foolish road to go down for people. I don't think really the kind of the structural arrangement of Gardaí and where the superintendent is located in a particular area is what's most important to people. I think, as you said earlier, it's having these guards on the ground. Mm-hmm. It's having more of a focus on community policing. It's having people in local areas being able to make autonomous decisions about funding and where the resources should be directed in a local area. And I think once people maybe learn more about this plan, I mean, we've had so many reviews into the guards, the Guard Inspectorate report in 2016, the review in the future of policing. They all made the same recommendations in this regard, and I think it's very welcome to see the Garda Commissioner come out and make these changes and do it as a matter of, you know, of a matter of some urgency.
I always, when I think about the guards, go back to that defining initial comment by the first Commissioner of the Guards, Commissioner Staines, at a very difficult time when we were just after a civil war, when there was guns all over the place, and he said, "We shall keep the Garda Síochána shall keep the peace not by force of arms but through the confidence of the people," which is a hugely important cultural approach and I think benefits our country. We don't have an armed police. And that will be strengthened by investing in community policing, in having guards that are close to people in the community. So I completely support that. And I agree with Colette. I think we've had so many reports. They've been sitting on shelves now for the last 4 or 5 years. Yeah. They're all saying the same thing.
They're all saying what Drew Harris has put forward, by the way.
And but Drew Harris is acting on the recommendations of the various reports.
They're all literally following it.
So I think it is time to stop just publishing reports and start acting. And start
will it work this time? Will it happen?
I think we... I think there's going to be a backlash from Garda members, and I think that's going to be even more forceful,
I think, than the opposition in local communities. So I think that Drew Harris is going to have a job ahead of him trying to convince...
But the one thing is we did bring in somebody new. We brought in somebody to say, look, these are the reports we've done, but put your structure in place. And I do think we owe it to give him that opportunity to succeed.
We're going to move to the cost of rent, where we started this week actually discussing on this programme. I mean, they're absolutely staggering. Colin Brophy, you've been in the studio many, many times with Sean defending the government's position on the housing crisis, but it's starting to look like your government's plans to lower the cost of rent they're really not working.
Yeah, well, I think the only real long-term solution to lowering the cost of rent is to increase the supply of housing. And we're actually beginning to see that that's happening. We're very actively beginning to see 20-something thousand house starts this year. There's an increase in planning permissions. There's a real type of turnaround in the amount that's actually happening out there. That's
but
the
people
long, that's
don't the, see that, that, that on I know the ground. That, do you understand that?
I absolutely do. Because that's the long-term solution.
It's staggering. The
problem is that supply is still not meeting that demand.
But you've been saying that as a mantra for donkey's years.
No, it's not a mantra, Miriam. It's a statement of fact. And as long as that's the case, you're going to have
The problem is Fine Gael have a blind faith in market policies to solve our housing crisis when the market on housing does not work and is not a market.
Very regulated market.
Can I give you... I'm a TD for Dublin Bay South, which is probably the centre of this crisis. Okay, all parts of Dublin and other cities, Cork, Galway, Limerick, are in real difficulty, but it's incredibly difficult, impossible now for any young person to rent, or certainly to rent and save.
It really is, to try and get a house.
There are about 1,000 apartments being built in the centre, down in the docks. You think, great, so supply is coming up. Yeah. About 700 of them are already contracted to the large multinational companies that are based there. So there's no apartments for the local community. There's no major social housing projects happening. The glass bottle site has still got tumbleweeds running around it. Mm-hmm. 5 years after we're saying that we wanted to do something down there. It is a lack of action by the state, a lack of intervention in the sort of projects that we've been pushing, cost rental investment, where we do public...
But you can't say they're not doing things, cause like because they're constantly saying they have new projects, Owen
Murphy.
They're constantly
announcing things.
Eamon, what would... If you were Minister of Housing tomorrow, you were Owen Murphy, what's the first thing you do?
I would take Broadstone Garage... I would say from CIE, we're going to move those buses out there. We're going to turn it to a site for cost rental housing in the centre of the city. Okay. I would go to the Irish Army and say in Cahill Brough Barracks, and this is my constituency, so maybe I have a vested interest. Yeah. We will build a brand new barracks for the Army in Baldonnell or some other suitable location. And we will use that 30 acre site to provide thousands of cost rental housing where everyone has a chance of getting lower cost rental close to the centre of the city.
Proposals.
Yeah, but the problem is the government has been bringing forward many proposals like that on many, many sites, many, many different types of housing, many initiatives. Every single one of them individually is a couple of thousand houses here or a couple of hundred. It's still, and we acknowledge this, it's still not reaching equilibrium. What Eamon has just outlined there, by the way, I'm sorry to say this without being, I think, would not make a damn bit of difference.
Excuse me. It certainly would in my area.
You see, Eamon, you can be micro on this, but you know that what's needed is what the government is doing. They've put in billions to try and get tens and tens of thousands of houses built, not just trying to say I'll build a thousand in my constituency,
several thousand,
and I'll be happy.
The first housing plan from a Fine Gael government was 2014. We are now, and a crisis was acknowledged at that point. We are now in 2019. We are 5 years down the road. And what do we see? Do we see any improvements? Do we see rents going down? Do we see the supply manifestly going up? What we see are hotels being built in Dublin, and what we see are student accommodation.
Colette Brown is speaking.
You had a good run of it, and I think that I think we need to go, you know, underscore the figures here so that people understand how bad the situation is in Dublin now. At the moment, for the first time ever, the average person renting is spending over €2,000 a month to rent a place. That's €500 more than most people are spending on their mortgages around the country, and it's about €600 more than rent was at the height of the boom. So my question to Colm is, how expensive is too expensive? When is this going to stop? Colm has said that, you know, it's just the market dictating that the rents are going up and we need more supply. Well, they've been saying we need more supply for the last 5 years. They've had plans for the last 5 years. When are these huge increases in rent going to stop?
And this is the point I started off making. First of all, most of the increase in rent we saw in the recent figures came before the rent control zones really began to bite in.
There's been no enforcement for those rent control measures.
Well, the figures seem to indicate that the rent control zones are working in the areas where they're in place. The other thing is we have increased supply. So we've gone from a situation where literally a few years ago we were talking about a small number of thousand houses to 20-something thousand houses, but we need more than
that
again.
I agree completely with Colette as well. 2014 we've been talking about there being some sort of changes into the supply. It's not even just the supply itself, it's the standard of accommodation, which is pretty bad. anybody trying to rent a place has to lower their expectations. Families living in homes like that, student accommodation, and also in comparison to your disposable income as well. People are spending so much money on not just rent or mortgages, but like they don't have any time to any money to spend, any way of developing, you know, getting a bigger house or even having a proper standard of living. I'm moving back to Brussels in a couple of months' time, and just this week looked at 6 very reasonable, decent places to live in the city of Brussels within 15 minutes to my work environment, 15 minutes to a great creche, which costs under €700 a month, which is all in.
All the listeners are going to be looking up Brussels.
And all of those, all of the places that aren't taking a major chunk, a reasonable chunk out of a salary, but something that you could actually have a normal life as well. And that was just in 1 day or 2 days of actually searching. And then looking at what would be available in Dublin, the stress of trying to find a creche, or if we were ever moving out, that would just be an absolute nightmare. It's easier to leave the country, essentially.
I want to move on, actually, because we had a wonderful young man on the show during the week, Conor Dillon. He's a student from the Central Remedial Clinic. And he was talking about the cut to the disability training grant of €31.80 a week. Eamon Ryan, what was your reaction to that cut?
Well, I have a slightly personal aspect of relation to it because I have an 18-year-old son who's got disability. And maybe speaking for a lot of parents with similar kids that age, not kids anymore because you're an adult at 18, but the state's approach to education with disability is kind of, you know, you're done at 18. Yeah. You know, you've done your leaving cert, you're grand, then you go out, you go. That's not the case with people with disability. They often have, you know, it's not, your timelines are different. And I think it's an unfortunate legacy. I mean, I think it maybe goes back even to the Cathy Sinnott case way back, where the state kind of, you know, the argument was whether you had a right to an education or not. And the state can maybe grudge in the end said yes. And they said, yeah, but we're going to stop it at 18. And it's not that the state doesn't do some good things. Like my son has been in a brilliant school, Satanta out in Sir Logan Road, superb. And its level of services are much better than they would have been 20, 30 years ago. But this kind of cliff edge disability thing where once you get 18, it all stops. And then you have to start again in a whole new world of where does your disabled son or daughter go next is a real difficulty. And that's what I was thinking on that particular story. It's an example of that kind of where we shouldn't do stop start or you know, kind of where we should have a plan for right through into all of life learning effectively.
And I'll let you in, John, but on that, it seemed like a particularly pernicious cut, €31.80. Well, it makes such a difference to this young man's life.
There was the minister, and I mean, I don't think anybody would doubt Mr. McGrath's bona fides in this area. And I mean, what he has outlined and what's been made very clear is, I mean, we have to remember there's about nearly the guts of €2 billion being spent by the government on services in this area in 2019. And the idea pretty much is in phasing out this and transferring the money to provide additional places. So it effectively will provide 300 additional places to people.
Why does the money need to come from people with disabilities?
Why can't you just
provide extra places? I mean, in the context of the overall health budget or even in the context of the €2 billion that's been directed towards services for disabilities, it is such a tiny, tiny figure, yet it is such a disproportionately large impact on the people. I think this is a miserly cut. It's a miserable cut. It's regressive. It's mean. It's nasty. And I can't believe that members of the government are standing over it, having heard interviews from people this week, from people who are going to be really, really, really impacted by it.
Well, not everybody has ever received this payment, so there is a situation now where you'll have a 300 extra places. You have a very substantial budget there. I know people are going to say what's just been said there, but obviously...
Do you not agree with what I said?
I happen to agree with the fact that I think the minister has made what he considers...
And so you're in favour of 31 years age being taken off people with disabilities?
Someone whose judgment I trust in the disability area and someone who's responsible for ensuring that nearly €2 billion gets spent in disability area in 2019.
Every government, you know, really should be striving towards dignity, you know, and equality for people. And the idea that you would take out €31.80 from somebody who's trying to engage in further education that already has a disability. When you look at the 60 million euro squandered on the public services card and the massive overrun in the health sector already.
The
children's hospital, exactly. So, and that you would take the €31.80 again from people, the coffers of people with disability, why couldn't you just find it elsewhere? But it is a really good example about the sort of the separation between government and actually people on the ground, that you, that those obstacles we put in front of people with disabilities.
I mean, able-bodied students of the CESI grant, so when there are people are going back to college all over the country, they're applying to the CESI grant so they can access education. And why should it be any different for students with disabilities? Why shouldn't they also have a grant that they can access? Eamon, I just want to
move before we close. We began the show today with the fires in the Amazon and obviously the Mercosur deal. I mean, I've interviewed you many times about environmental issues. It's what one of your, you know, most things you believe in. How concerned are you about those fires? And do you think we should do something in relation to the Mercosur deal?
I think we I'm terrified by what's going on at the moment, not just in the fires, but also the melting that's been occurring in the Greenland ice sheet this summer. Even there's a report today in the Irish Times, Kevin O'Sullivan has it again, about the Gulf Stream starting to weaken. The fundamental natural systems that we rely on for our survival are changing and are at risk and a threat. And it's as big as that. And I think people realise that, they understand that. And I think it should drive a completely different understanding of what we need to do to respond. It's not just about the Amazons, but what we do here too. But in regard to the Amazon, and the real problem there is that the fear is that this is being driven by political leadership in Brazil who are actually instigating it. I think the Taoiseach, I welcome last night, the Taoiseach said that we wouldn't sign the Mercosur deal if this wasn't rectified. But that's a decision that's 3 or 4 years away. I think we need to make a decision and a statement today to say, sorry, everything's off the table. Sanctions are on the table unless Brazil changes its ways today, not in 2 or 3 years' time.
So that's maybe what the G7 could do. I think Macron is right
to bring it up there. And I think the Secretary General of the United Nations has raised it today as well. It needs immediate response because it's been driven by political leadership that thinks you can thrash the world. It's the same in America. Mm. It's the same in Russia. It's the same in Saudi Arabia. We have to stand up for our planet.
I think there are always around this time of year, there are always kind of forest fires in the Amazon. But the problem is that under the current government in Brazil, they're not putting in the resources to tackle the fires. So they're just essentially letting them burn. And I agree. I think the international community has to stand up and say something. Because
you have to ask the question, can a leader actually, I know it's Trumpish, but can a leader actually accuse NGOs of setting fires? I mean, it's unbelievable what is actually happening, which is what he did.
Well, given that President Trump tried to buy Greenland during the week, I suppose
we didn't get time to discuss that, which we were going to. But look, my thanks to Shona Murray, to Colin Brophy, to Colette Brown and to Eamon Ryan.